I am Plato on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I'm delighted to welcome to the program now Randy Cohen. For 12 years, he wrote the Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine. I can't remember how I started reading it online back in high school, but I remember loving it in those early days of the Internet and reading his witty, thoughtful, clear, and cogent style. Later did I learn that Mr. Cohen was a writer on the Late Night with David Letterman program, for which he won four Emmy Awards. He also wrote for TV Nation and The Rosie O'Donnell Show. He has been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic, and was the creator and host of Person, Place, Thing, a radio program on public radio station WAMC. After over 600 columns where he discussed ethical issues surrounding workplace drama, downloading music off the Internet, paying one's share at dinner, issues of race and religion, and other pertinent and fascinating dilemmas, Randy Cohen left the Times. He collected some of the queries sent his way in a recent book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. It's a marvelous collection, difficult to put down, funny and poignant, too. I've had a great time reading out questions with friends and getting their thoughts in the week since the Christmas holidays when I bought the book for myself. The book is published by Chronicle Books. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Randy Cohen. Mr. Cohen, good morning.
Good morning. That was such a nice introduction. I wish you would just run that over and over and not listen to me jibber jabber.
Well, I'll play it again then. I really appreciate you doing this because, as I said before we started, the book's been out for a while, and there's really no reason for you to do this. So I was thinking in reading the book and in preparing for this, ethics seems to be something that we seem to know what it is, right? But if you put a gun to my head right now, I probably couldn't come up with a coherent definition of what ethics is. So let's begin there. What is it? And is it the same thing as, say, something that's legal or moral?
Those are big and complicated questions. The working definition I found convenient is to regard ethics as the effect of our actions on other people, which is different from sin. You know, first of all, it involves actions, not thoughts. Ethics doesn't allow for mental transgressions, whereas in some religions you can think sinful thoughts. You can covet your neighbor's ox, right? That's in the Old Testament. That's in the Ten Commandments, and that is itself a transgression, a moral transgression to the people who observe the Ten Commandments. Ethics is only ethics when it's action and when your actions involve other people. So any harm you would do to yourself, for instance, would not be an ethical question.
There's a line in the book, tolerance ends where harm begins.
I mean, that's very nice. Did I write that?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Wow. I should stick with it. What's ethical and what's legal are not necessarily synonymous. For much of American history, slavery was legal, but there was no point at which slavery was ethical. The legal system of any particular jurisdiction is, in some regards, a moral instrument. It's a way a people expresses its sense of right and wrong. But the laws, many things. The law is often an expression just of power, of the power of the people who write it. I mean, a very great man named Karl Marx would have pointed out how much the law is an expression simply of who has money, mm-hmm. which is often synonymous with who has power. So what's legal and what's ethical overlap, but needn't be the same. Ethical and moral, the way I was taught, those words were synonymous, one deriving from Latin and one deriving from Greek, and I use them interchangeably, but I know not everyone does, that some people make a very convenient distinction, a very useful distinction, that they use moral to denote underlying fundamental principles and ethics as the way we translate those principles into action.
Now, do you find that being ethical means different things in different cultures? I mean, you're in the United States today, I'm in Canada. There may be a little difference, but there must be differences, say, with different cultures, different races, different religions.
There are two schools of thought on this. One is that ethics is nothing more than an expression of a culture's values, that it's very local, it's very parochial, that it's just particular to a time and place, and that there's no fundamental claim on one culture. You know, that Attila the Hun would see his behavior within his culture as every bit as ethical as I see my own sterling conduct in the modern world. That's not my perspective. That I believe there are fundamental ethical principles that apply in every time and every place. And while a particular culture may have different prevailing values than I observe, I believe in my sort of deranged vanity that if I were just a little smarter and a little more eloquent, I could convince, you know, the ancient Romans that they shouldn't own slaves, for instance, or the modern Saudis that maybe they should allow women to drive.
Mm-hmm. So is the essence, then, of ethics for you the title of the book, To Be Good?
Yes, yes. And that if you start with, I think, a fairly simple premise that I think is demonstrably true, you can get remarkably far in constructing a kind of universal code of ethics. And one place I start is with a profound belief in an egalitarian society, that I feel I'm entitled to the same respect as other human beings, but no more. And other human beings are entitled to the same respect as I. And if you start there, then that gets you to very interesting places. That you could then, in fact, argue with the ancient Romans that maybe slavery isn't so great. And you could argue with the Saudis that, well, you can't discriminate on the basis of gender. But you have to buy that premise.
So then how do we get away from that? I mean, there are people that don't buy what you're hoping for.
You know, I think they're remarkably few, and increasingly fewer, that it seems, this truth seems self-evident, and that you can see it embodied in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights explicitly expresses that idea. And it's interesting that they got so many member states to endorse it. And if you're a cynical person, you might say, well, sure. Even the Saudis, I believe, endorsed that document knowing that it was unenforceable. But once people do sign on to a set of moral principles such as that what the UN constructed, then you can start to have that discussion, and it's a discussion worth having.
So what happens then with society when bad things happen? Like if there's corruption, if there's greed, crime, is that, do you think, because there are ethical lapses?
Corruption is an ethical transgression. It's not caused by an ethical transgression. It is an ethical transgression, yeah. There's a big change in my thinking that occurred over the 12 years I wrote the column, and that perhaps gets us to that. When I began, I saw ethics as essentially an individual matter. It involved decisions that an individual would make in a moment of crisis, you know. Should I shoot this dog or not? You know, should I steal that money or not? And I over the years, moved away from that very much indeed to a different approach to this. That is, once we accept notions of right and wrong, and I think we find a great deal of unanimity about that, at least in broad strokes, once we know what we mean by right and wrong, well, how do we get people to behave in this way? And it is not by seeing them as isolated individuals making these individual decisions, but rather by seeing them, or us, as members of communities and who are inclined to act the way the other people in the community act. That is, if you look around and your neighbors are all paying their taxes, you tend to pay your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
If your neighbors are all jumping over the turnstile to get on the subway, you tend to do that, too. That most of us act no better or worse than our neighbors. Most ancient Romans acted like ancient Romans. Most modern Canadians act like other modern Canadians.
Go ahead if I interrupted you.
Well, what can seem unattractive to this kind of argument to people is that it seems a little mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems a little reductive, and it seems to deny individual responsibility or individual accountability, but I don't see it that way. And to me, well, here's a good example, that organ donors, and I'm speaking of cadaverous donation. Mm-hmm. You're dead. Will you allow your organs to be transplanted to other people?
Right.
Presumably, you are no longer using your kidneys. You are in the grave.
Yeah.
In the U.S., our system is opt-in, that you have to sign, usually on your driver's license. You just say, yes, you can have my organs. And only 25% of us do. In Sweden, they use the opposite system. They use opt-out, where the presumption is that you're dead, you're not using your kidneys, they're available to anyone, unless for any reason you decide you don't want that to happen, and you sign your driver's license, in effect, there.
Yeah.
Well, among the Swedes, more than 80% of them make their organs available. I don't think it's because individual Swedes and individual Americans at moments of moral crisis are reaching opposite conclusions. I think the question was asked in a way, a community of donors was established in a way that inclines people to do the right thing.
But is it also laziness, that the fact that they probably didn't think to opt out? And it, perhaps ethical lapses come about because of, we're just too...
I don't know. It's hard to see the Swedes as lazier than the Americans, you know. I think it's... Or even if you do regard it as a matter of laziness or indifference on people's
yeah.
parts, it's interesting that you can get them to do the right thing just by creating a slightly different social structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a very hard thing to do. I see that as very encouraging, that people are who they are. People have busy lives. Even if you regard that as lazy, then the question still remains, how do you get people to do the right thing? And I assume we would both agree that, well, it is the right thing to help. You can save other people's lives
mm-hmm.
in a way, at no cost to you. That's virtuous conduct. And it's very, very easy to create a social structure that accommodates for what we're like as human beings and gets us to behave virtuously. I think that's great news.
No, you didn't leave the Times and the Ethicist column because of some ethical lapse, right?
No, I was fired.
You were?
Yes, I was,
yeah.
but in a very undramatic way. Well, all right, I never should have taken a swing at that cop, I grant you. Now, in retrospect, it looks so clear. No, it was nothing like that. A new editor took over at the magazine and just cleaned house. He got rid of every contract writer. Deborah Solomon, who wrote that very lovely Q&A at the mm-hmm. front of the book, and Ben Zimmer, who wrote the language column. Everybody was gone. And while it caused much weeping in my house, and I don't think I was treated unfairly. He's the editor, and he gets to run whatever kind of magazine he wants, however foolishly he conceives it.
So one assumes that having had the job for as long as you had, and writing this book now and continuing to talk about ethics as you do, that you lead a life that's unblemished.
You would be foolish to think it. I don't think I ought to be held to that demand. That I wouldn't want to be an utter hypocrite. But I don't know if you've met a lot of sports writers. You know, there's not one in ten who can, you know, hit the jump shot from beyond 15 feet, and nor should they be expected to. That their job is not to be athletes, but to write about athletes in a way the readers find interesting. And that was the self-serving rationale I always used, that I'm not meant to personify virtue, you know, to be a role model for the kids. I meant to just write about these questions in a way that people find useful. I try to do that, although, you know, I'm always mindful that given the nature of the job, had I been dragged off in handcuffs, it would be particularly humiliating.
Yeah, I mean, the skills that you brought to the job, I mean, when you look back at the outset of the 12 years that you were there at the Times, what did you think they were looking for, and what do you think you brought to the job?
Well, I have no idea what they were looking for, and I was astonished that they were looking for me. It's the last thing I expected, that it was an in-house idea, the column. And the editors of the magazine conceived it and then invited a bunch of people to audition. And they gave us each three questions, very much like the sort of thing that would then ultimately run in the column. And it was just really, really fun to write the answer to these, to try to solve these little ethical puzzles. But I seemed an unlikely person to be on their list in any case. Most of the other candidates, I gather, they're very discreet or secretive, depending on your perspective, at the times. And I believe the other candidates were more plausible in that they had strong philosophy backgrounds, as I understand it. I have none. I was a music major in college, and they knew me because I had written for the magazine before and other parts of the paper, and they did throw a couple of writers into the mix. So that's how I came to their attention, and I did the audition, you know, just one weekend. I believe I got $200 too, so it wasn't, you know, pretty sweet. And it was just enormously fun to do. But I thought that would be the end of it. I think there were around a dozen candidates. And after that, gee, I just don't know. Every job I've ever had, 1,000 other people could have done it, and they might have done it a bit differently, but they certainly could have done it just as well. I think that's true for all of us, you know, unless you're Eric Clapton, you know. Mm-hmm. Someone else could do your job, and they do it great. I have to figure that because I had a background writing humor that the Times felt, well, that was the style column they wanted to run, and that might be an asset. And that maybe the topic just seemed a bit daunting for a general interest magazine that people are meant to read on a Sunday morning, and if you could leaven it with humor, that was all to the good.
So what was the process in the 12 years that you were there when you'd write the column? I mean, you must have gotten more questions than you had space to write.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds. It was usually a couple of hundred emails a week. The process is entirely handled on email. Of those couple of hundred, about half would be new questions and about half would be people pointing out how wrong I got it in the previous week.
Mm.
Or sometimes many more than that. Yeah. So I would just go through them and pick out the ones that seemed interesting to me and hope that those would be interesting to the reader. I just wasn't sophisticated enough to have any other way of working out what the readers would enjoy. I just hoped that if I found it interesting, they'd find it interesting.
And then you would consult professionals as well, say?
I would for technical questions, but not for moral questions. That I felt moral reasoning was my job, so I never went to any philosophers or any clergy, for instance, and sought their moral guidance. I would go to technical experts, and for instance, as we were discussing before, sometimes a question of ethics at least impinges on a question of law. For instance, there was something my neighbors had were growing pot in their backyard. Must I report them to the police? So mm-hmm. I had to at least know what the law said. I didn't have to counsel people to obey the law, but it was incumbent on me to know the law. So I would consult lawyers for that sort of thing. And over the years, I got to know, like many, experts on American constitutional law and questions of free expression at the Civil Liberties Union, or experts on how the law affects reproductive rights, that kind of expert, yes. I would consult doctors. Many doctors wrote to the column, which seems a little disconcerting, doesn't it? What do I know?
Yeah.
So there was an excellent medical ethicist at the AMA who would advise me. Those kind of experts, yes. But not experts in moral reasoning.
Now, I always wondered, would people write you, and then maybe constantly write you because whatever query or quandary they had, what was an emergency?
No, I think it became apparent early on that I was so slow. This process was very, very slow. That when I got an email with a question I thought would interest the readers, I would write a sort of first draft and put it aside, and it might sit on my pile to be done. You know, I would then consult an expert. I would show this to my editor, and they would just sit there. You know, a dozen of them that when it was time to turn the column around that week, that I would pick two that I thought paired up nicely. So questions could sit there for months, and I think the readers got to know that if they needed a quick, useful answer, I was not the place to go.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you'd worked for, what was it, 4 years with Letterman?
No, seven.
7 years. And then
7 years.
And then one of the things that you're known for is that you created the top 10 list, right?
Well, Maybe I did. I mean, that's debatable.
He's good.
And I never asserted that claim.
I've heard him say that, though.
Yeah, I've heard him say that, too. I think he's close. And it's unbelievably gratifying to hear him say that. But the show was a staff-written show. You know, there were 10 writers on staff. And like, this idea, like many ideas, has many, many parents. And I can remember the conversation that led to it, that I was very much part of, but it seems overreaching to claim that. It embarrasses me a little bit. I wish it were so, but it's not the case that I came in and had it all written up and go, here's what we should do, and this is what it will be like. It emerged out of a conversation with some of my colleagues.
No, I'm a fan of his. I'm watching him for years. So I read the sections of the book where you talk about situations that he was in. You talk about the ethical issues regarding comedy with regards to jokes that he made about Sarah Palin's daughters, and then of course the affair with a staffer that came to light in recent years. As someone who's interested in him as a broadcaster, as a performer, what did these two episodes show you or instructive about who David Letterman is?
I have enormous respect and admiration for Dave, both as a performer and as a person. He was a great boss too. That in 7 years, I never heard him raise his voice to a writer. It was just a wonderful place to work, and it's always a pleasure to work for someone who you respect. You want to respect your boss, and that invariably it was, we'd write something and Dave would make it better. So I respected him as a comic performer, but also as a person, in that I felt Dave lived in a moral universe, in that he was aware, he didn't know, that doesn't mean he always did the right thing, but he was aware that his conduct could be subjected to moral scrutiny, and he did. And I can remember early on, in the first years of the show, we used to have a sort of line and running, fabulous babes as guests, sort of bonehead models. Mm-hmm. And there was someone, it was a hand tool company called Rigid Tools, and there was someone called the Rigid Tools Girl, who was this, incredibly curving, delicious-looking young woman who didn't have, a thought in her head, and she was a guest on the show, and Dave really bullied her and hurt her feelings, and there was a lot of conversation after that episode, and a kind of moral decision that was the wrong thing to do, and we would never have that kind of guest on the show again, and that stemmed entirely from Dave. And I don't want to overhype him. Mm-hmm. The part of that was, it looks very bad to reduce a young woman to tears on your show, and he was mindful of the of his reputation. But I've worked at other shows where no one would have ever even raised the moral question, and he really did, and that's worthy of respect. And you could see it, too. So I thought the Palin joke adhered to Dave's idea of moral comedy. And there were sort of guidelines, at any workplace, there are the written rules and the more important unwritten rules. And you just breathed the unwritten rules in. And one of them was, you don't make fun of people for things that are beyond their control. So you can't make fun of a bald guy like me for not having hair. But you can make fun of an actor for choosing to be in a bad movie. It has to be volitional. That's an interesting ethical idea. You don't bully the weak. You attack the people who assail them. You should be attacking the powerful. That's your job. And it's amazing how often he adhered to that. And I thought the Palin joke, for which he was roundly criticized, adhered to those rules. That the Palins had a certain... He was tweaking her for her hypocrisy and setting herself up as a moral arbiter, the Palin daughter, who was 18 at the time, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he was tweaking, I believe it was Alex Rodriguez, right, the baseball player, for his manifold infidelities, so we read in the papers. That was all fine. I felt Sarah Palin deliberately twisted the meaning of that joke to cast herself and her family as victims. The Sarah Palin way. So it was a little disappointing when Dave ultimately succumbed to pressure and apologized, because he never should have apologized for that joke. He did nothing wrong. It was a good, it wasn't a great joke aesthetically, but morally it was a good joke, and Dave correctly analyzed it morally before he apologized. His infidelities were more troubling. And there I thought he acted very, very badly. Not insofar as one knows to the young woman involved. Although there's an argument that, insofar as we could see, she in no way was bullied into this. It was as consensual can be. She loved being involved with Dave. So that part, she was not the victim there. If you'll accept the idea that consent is possible when there's such disparities of power. I mean, there's an argument the other way, that when your boss says, would you like to, well, you can't say no.
Yeah.
Consent is meaningless in that setting, and that's a pretty good argument. But seeing what I knew about Dave in the office, given that premise, I don't think she was victimized. But I do think there were victims, and I think it was the other members of the staff, that if you can get ahead professionally by sleeping with the boss, and what getting ahead here meant being on the show, doing stage work and little sketches, we all liked doing that. Was she getting to do that because of her relationship with Dave or because of her merits? And once he's personally involved with a staffer, it's impossible to make that distinction anymore. Even he can't know the answer to that. So, yeah, he shouldn't have been sleeping in-house. He should have been having his affairs, if he was going to have affairs, not with people he supervised. It's too destructive to a workplace.
Now, in the book, there's a marvelous exchange of letters with John Patrick Shanley.
What a guy.
Yeah, and he was upset with you to begin with, and then I guess you have this discussion with him. I think it's a great illustration of the interaction that went on with people who wrote in as well as read the column. And then it also shows how you evolved yourself. After the 12 years or so that you did this, do you think you looked at the world differently?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, most significantly in the what we were discussing earlier, that I moved away from seeing ethics as primarily an individual, an individualist, taking an individualist approach to ethics, to taking a community approach to ethics. That was the big change. But also in the way I just did the job, that people can be very cruel with email. I'm sure this happens to everyone. People say things in email they would never say to your face or even on the phone for any number of reasons. It's anonymous. You can hit send a little too quickly. You're getting no cues about how your intemperate words are hurting another person's feelings. And when I used to get these unbelievably cruel emails, I used to think, well, you think that's cruel. I'm a trained professional. I can write something 50 times crueler. And, our parents say, well, no, if you do that, you'll feel bad. Well, no, you won't. You'll feel great. Getting your own back feels really good. But what it doesn't ever do is change anybody's mind or attitude. I think I was succumbing to the tendency to reply in kind. If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. If you're mean to me, I'll be mean to you. It got me nowhere. And so I switched strategies deliberately, to the more Jesus approach, the approach Jesus recommends. I believe it's Jesus, isn't it? A soft answer turneth away wrath.
Yeah.
That sounds very New Testament. And so I would, no matter how harsh the email, I would try to focus on the actual points the person was making, if indeed they were, and just say, well, thank you for your note, and then respond in a very calm way just to that. And it's amazing how often I would get an apology.
Huh.
As you mentioned, when Shanley first wrote to me, he was pretty fierce, and I just put all that aside and just engaged with the issue, and he was spectacularly willing to do that in an extremely intelligent and thoughtful way, and neither of us changed the other's mind, I felt. But by the end of that exchange, the tone had been completely transformed into something quite respectful on both parts, and Shanley couldn't have been nicer. I mean, I asked his permission to run the letters in the book, and he instantly said yes. It all turned on, by the way, we should say, on can someone without consent make alterations in a play.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You didn't write the play. Can you change lines in someone's play? In a pretty entertaining way. It involves someone's mother in an old folks home doing performances of a Neil Simon play and thinking she could write funnier lines than Neil Simon. and I thought, well, this is going to be an aesthetic disaster, but is it a moral disaster? And I thought not, and went on to make my case. Even though she had no legal right to do this, that was clear. And Shanley was ferocious in his defense of the playwright's, from his perspective, right to have his work unaltered unless he can assents to that. He's wrong, by the way. I'm right. And you can find out for yourself.
When they read the book, yeah.
Yeah.
So self-servingly, does having a conscience, does leading an ethical life, a highly ethical life, I should say, does that mean a happier sort of life?
There's a strong case to be made that it does. And you have to ask the question, well, okay, what is the purpose of this entire exercise? Why be good? Why is it worth being ethical? And it's Benjamin Franklin, one of our founding fathers, who gave a terrific answer to this in his autobiography. Franklin, when he was a very young man, set out on this project of his own devising to become morally perfect, in his words, and he failed. But in doing this, he asked that question, why be good? And he said, we're good in order to be happy even in this world, by which he meant it wasn't an attempt to get to heaven. You're not virtuous because of some religious obligation. He felt you weren't virtuous because of an obligation to the law. He thought that our being virtuous would promote a happy life. And he meant happy with a capital H, you know, not from drink to drink or for the next 5 minutes. That what kind of community, again, will have the happiest members? And he thought it is one in which people act ethically towards each other. And I found this very persuasive. And that, yes, that's the answer. We're good in order to be happy.
Now, I understand Person, Place, Thing isn't on the air anymore.
Person, Place, Thing is still very much alive, although it's not being done for WAMC right now. Person, Place, Thing's being done as a series of live events at this place in New York called the 92nd Street Y,
uh-huh.
So I'm doing it live on stage with a live audience. It's a sort of interview show, and we just started doing weekly studio recordings. So starting on the 18th, our new website goes up, and I don't even have the URL for it yet, or I would so happily give it to you. It will be within the 92nd Street Y's website, where once a week we'll post a new one of these, and what these are is it's a sort of interview show, but built on this premise that people are particularly interesting when they're not speaking directly about themselves, but about something they care about, and I provide them a structure within which they can do that. So each guest comes ready to talk about one person, one place, and one thing that they find particularly meaningful. Love it or hate it, it doesn't matter. As long as you have strong feelings about it. And it's been great in the sense that we've been lucky enough to get some very good talkers who then go on to tell stories they never would have told. So I'm very happy with this. It was on, Dan Savage, the sex columnist. Mm-hmm. Dan Savage's Person was Caroline Matilda, the teenage sister of George III, King of England, who at the age of 17 is married off to the King of Denmark, has this extraordinary experience there, is dead by the time she's 23. It's just an amazing life. But it's not what you'd think of as a Dan Savage life.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan said, no, I'd rather talk about the Tudors than anything, but no one ever asks me.
Mm.
Well, we ask, and he was wonderful. I mean, we've had, just 2 weeks ago we did Judy Collins on stage.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And what I liked was the Ed Koch thing, where he talks about where he's going to be buried.
He was so wonderful, you know. As I suspect most of your listeners will know, he died within the last week.
Yeah.
We did the interview a year ago in December, and he'd become in his 80s, and he was extremely combative. He'd become a kind of militant Zionist, and that's all I wanted to talk about in ferocious ways. But when we got to Place, Where's Your Place? He spoke about, he had chosen his burial plot in Trinity Cemetery, which seemed a very odd choice for someone who identifies so strongly with the Jewish community. That's not a Jewish cemetery. Well, why? Well, because it's the only, what I've learned to call, active cemetery in Manhattan. It's the only place in Manhattan where they can put a body in the ground. Hmm. And he does not want to be cremated, and he's not leaving, he said, ever. But it was this occasion for him to speak about his own mortality with a kind of modesty and a kind of courage that was genuinely moving. You know, it was tender, it was quiet, it was thoughtful. He was wonderful.
Yeah, it was very New York from listening to it.
Yeah. He that's a very important thing to him, New York.
Yeah.
It's very much a part of who he is to himself.
You know, I could talk all day with you, but I'm looking at the clock. I've kept you longer than I said I would, so I'll let you go. But I must say, it's been a real pleasure having you on today, and an honor for me to have you on the program.
Oh, no, fun for me, too. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome. The book is called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. It's published by Chronicle Books. Do pick it up. It's such a wonderful book. It's author Randy Cohen on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.